Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, what happens after we die? Neuroscientist David Eagleman shares some of his thoughts that inspired him to write his new book of fiction, meditating on one of the oldest questions humanity has ever faced.
Unless we act as if we can sort this out, you might as well just get a hat and some suntan lotion and write a letter of apology to your grandchildren.
2009 was meant to be the year of the Green Budget, but after last week's announcements by government, many environmentalists were left a bit miffed. We'll take you through the highs, lows, and the questions that remain for anyone interested in saving the planet. All that, plus how the Great Wall of China got longer, the smell of the galactic centre, and apparently a human clone. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to everyone listening, and also to Ian Sample. Ian, hello, you're our sole panellist this week.
Hi there.
Have you got all the knowledge you need for this week?
Always.
I was listening to one of your older podcasts that you were presenting, and you're quite an expert on a lot of things, I've realised.
Is this this is irony?
This isn't irony. I'm genuine. For the first time in my life, I'm being genuine about your skills. I'll stop.
Give me an example.
If this is exactly how you're going to respond, I'm not going to do it again. Anyway, our guest this week is neuroscientist David Eagleman. He studied at the Baylor College of Medicine and currently runs a lab that looks at time perception and synesthesia. At night, he writes fiction, and his first book, Some, is a collection of some of his thoughts on death, or rather, what might happen after we die. Here's an excerpt, a story called Subjunctive.
In the afterlife, you're judged not against other people, but against yourself. Specifically, you're judged against what you could have been. So the afterworld is much like the present world, but now it includes all the yous that could have been. In an elevator, you might meet more successful versions of yourself, perhaps the you that chose to leave your hometown 3 years earlier, or the you that happened to board an aeroplane next to a company president that then hired you. As you meet these yous, you experience a pride of the sort that you feel for a successful cousin. Although the accomplishments don't directly belong to you, it somehow feels close. But soon you fall victim to intimidation. These yous are not really you, they're better than you. They made smarter choices, worked harder, invested the extra effort in pushing on closed doors. These doors eventually broke open for them and allowed their lives to splash out in colourful new directions.
That was a passage titled Subjunctive from David's new book, Some. David, welcome to Science Weekly.
Thanks, great to be here.
We don't normally discuss fiction in this show, so tell us something about your background and how you, a neuroscientist, ended up writing fiction.
Well, as an undergraduate, I majored in British and American literature, and then I went into neuroscience after that, so I've always been a writer. But there's a very real sense in which science and art are the same thing. They're the same kind of pursuit. They both involve creativity and coming up with multiple hypotheses and often being able to hold multiple hypotheses in your head at the same time. So when I go home at night, I take some of those hypotheses that spring up during the day and I use fiction as a channel to express some of those and explore those ideas.
And so the idea is that you can have a bit of fun with some concepts that, you know, you don't necessarily think are scientific, but you think would be interesting just to philosophically or morally go into.
That's exactly right. They aren't serious proclamations about any sort of suggestion about the afterlife, of course. But what is serious is the exercise in the book of making up lots of new stories, because essentially when we come into this world, we're offered a few stories. We're offered the sort of the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions and some Eastern religions and just a sort of a pitifully few number of stories about something that we don't have any evidence on. And so it seems to make sense to entertain a larger part of the possibility space there. And essentially that's what this is doing in a fictional and fun way.
So you're creating an entirely new mythology for the world.
But the key is that all 40 stories are mutually exclusive. They're all contradictory. So none of them are meant in that sense to be a real mythology.
It sounds like a post-structuralist thing. Anyway, look, Subjunctive, the one we just heard. So this is quite amusing. It's basically about how you're judging yourself in the afterlife. Tell us a bit about this story.
What I found is that talking about the afterlife was just a fantastic playing field for exploring all the issues, all the joys and complexities of our own lives, of human nature. We're always facing lots of choices, and we have to deal sometimes with the fact that we make better and worse choices, and we're really good as humans at coming up with counterfactuals, thinking about what could have been.
In these 40 stories, you've written many, many, many more. You've selected these 40. You say each one's contradictory, but has each one got a separate message, or is each one exploring a separate thing? What is the difference between them all?
Interesting question. Yeah, I chose the 40 so that I could maximally get a mental stretch in different directions. So all 40 of them are meant to explore different topics. Of course, there is some overlap in the themes. The theme that overlaps the most is just sort of putting a lens onto our own lives and seeing what we find here.
It seems to me that what you're doing is you're posing scenarios about the afterlife in order to tell us how we should be in our lives now. And I just wondered whether you almost started with a problem that you sort of see in the way people live their lives at the moment, and then almost work back, okay, what's the afterlife scenario I can come up with, which really accentuates this point. And I'm thinking about one of your stories called Circle of Friends, I think, where you wake up in the afterlife, you go to work, there aren't many people around on the way to work. There are only the people that you already know in your life. So all your past lovers, all your teachers, the people you're closer to. But you never get to know anyone new. You never get to know how to, as you say, make railroads or to how to vulcanize a tire and things like this. Tell me how you came about each scenario.
I started with sort of scenarios about a possible afterlife, and it was essentially just an exercise in following it out to its logical conclusion and seeing where that would lead you. Right, so in Circle of Friends, the conclusion is that you start to feel lonely because there's nobody new to meet, because this is exactly the life you chose when you were alive. Mm. In other stories, though, as you know, God is the size of a microbe and doesn't know that we exist because we're at the wrong spatial scale. Or God is a married couple that's getting divorced. Or the afterlife's been taken over by committees. There are lots of different scenarios. And what I do is I sort of start each one with a little seed of an idea, and then I follow it through to its conclusion, with the punchline always being something that reflects back on us.
Why is the book called Some?
I chose that title for three reasons. Sum is the Latin word for I am, as in cogito ergo sum, and it's also the Greek term for the highest level of something, as in summa cum laude, and also the title story, you're living your afterlife, and you relive all of your experiences, but they're all shuffled into a different order, so all the moments that share a quality or group together. So, for example, you spend 6 straight days clipping your nails and 15 months looking for lost items, and you take your 200-day shower and so on. And so it's your same life. You live exactly the life you lived, but reshuffled in a different order. And it turns out in that order, it would be insufferable. And so it is the case that the whole is often greater than the sum of the parts. And that's also the meta message of the book. The book is really a celebration of the vastness of our ignorance.
Dave, just coming back to some of the science on this, I mean, do you think that advances in medicine and maybe particularly in neuroscience are shifting the line between what we actually define as life and death?
Oh, certainly. In fact, the legal definition of brain death has been something that's a source of intense debate, has been for the last 30 years and will continue to be, because it turns out that death is not an event, it's a process. And you can have various parts of your brain shut down, never to come back, while other parts of your brain are still chugging along just fine. So this has forced the medical and legal and ethical community to try to draw a line in the sand where they say, you know, what we think death is from a legal perspective. And this has become a very exciting field just recently, because now we're able to put people in the scanner, we're able to do neuroimaging on people in, let's say, a persistent vegetative state, and try to determine, is there anything going on inside the person? Is there any sort of consciousness and neural activity going on, which is something we couldn't do before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, David, thank you for now. We'll talk a bit more about your neuroscience a bit later. David's book, Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives, is available now from guardianbookshop.co.uk. Let's have a look now at some of the science stories from the past 7 days. Here's the News Jam.
News Jam. A maverick fertility expert who claims to be able to clone human beings has been condemned by other scientists for unethical practices. In a TV documentary last week, Panayotis Zavos claims to have cloned 14 human embryos so far and implanted 11 of them into the wombs of 4 women, but none survived. The cloning procedures were carried out in an unnamed location, since the work is illegal in the UK and many other parts of the world.
Doctors say that the condition of Stephen Hawking is improving after he was taken to hospital very ill in the middle of last week. The family of the 67-year-old physicist said they were looking forward to him making a full recovery after an illness caused him to pull out of a science conference in Arizona early this month to recover from a chest infection. A Cambridge University spokesman said Hawking was still having tests for a condition that was not related to his respiratory infection and was not life-threatening.
The Great Wall of China is even greater than once thought, after a two-year government mapping study uncovered new sections totaling about 180 miles. According to a report by the country's National Mapping Agency, the Great Wall is now around 3,900 miles long. Using infrared rangefinders and GPS devices, experts discovered portions of the wall that were built during the Ming Dynasty and were submerged over time by sandstorms that moved across the arid region.
And finally, astronomers searching for the building blocks of life in a giant dust cloud at the heart of the Milky Way have concluded that it tastes vaguely of raspberries. The find follows years of work by astronomers who used their 30-metre radio telescope on the enormous ball of dust and gas in the hope of spotting complex molecules that are vital for life. In the latest survey, astronomers sifted through thousands of signals from the cloud Sagittarius B2 at the centre of our galaxy, and they found a substance called ethyl formate, the chemical responsible for the flavour of raspberries. Curiously, ethyl formate has another distinguishing characteristic. It also smells of rum. Now, before we move on, we need the help of the mighty Science Weekly audience. The Guardian has been nominated for 6 Webby Awards. That's right, 6. And our podcasts are one of the nominations. I've been told that these are the Oscars of the internet. So if you could go to webbyawards.com and vote for us, make sure you cast a vote for us in the podcast category. And if you do, we'll promise we'll come back next week with more science goodness. Okay, well, let's get on to some of those stories a bit more. The serious one first, Panos Zavos. We've covered his stories before. Again, he's claimed to have cloned human embryos. Ian, what's different this time?
Well, essentially, it's the numbers. And one other thing, I mean, a documentary maker has been with him at his lab in the Middle East and has apparently spent time with him while he's been doing these experiments. And the program was showing him at work and so on, and I got sent a video of some cells sort of doing cellular type things down a microscope, although I wasn't able to tell from that whether they were cloned embryos or not. I mean, it's a tricky one for us because there's no doubt that this is interesting. There's no doubt, I don't think, that sooner or later someone will get a cloned embryo to implant in a womb. Human womb. But it's tricky because the veracity of this stuff. I mean, he has a track history, sadly, of not really being able to come up with the evidence that scientists have wanted. And so that makes it hard for us to report. I mean, do we say it anyway? Do we say it every time he claims something? I mean, it's a tricky one for the media.
And so here's what Professor Robert Winston has to say. I don't know of any credible evidence to suggest that Dr. Zavos can clone a human being. This seems to be yet another one of his claims to get repeated publicity. That's fair, isn't it? I mean, he does like his publicity. He never produces evidence. And as cynical as we can be about it, in this case, there's nothing to hold on to beyond the words of a documentary filmmaker, and in the world of science, that's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, there are layers of ethical issue here. I mean, if you think about when test tube babies were brought in that technology was brought in the 1970s, all the animal researchers showed that it was a safe thing to do. With cloning, it's very different. All the animal studies suggest that it's not all right. With every species so far, you get abnormalities when you first start doing this sort of thing, and to do it with humans is deeply unethical.
Now, you wrote a blog on this, Ian. What were some of the comments underneath?
So there's one here from someone called Son of a Baz again. He says, or she says, there is nothing wrong with cloning humans apart from our reaction towards the idea. We seem to think we are uncopyable as we are individual. A copy of me is not me, it's merely a copy. A clone would have its own experiences and therefore its own preferences. Unless my clone had the pleasure of being brought up by my parents in the late 1970s, it's probably not going to like half the things I like, so it would just be another good-looking fellow with an inherited ball patch. What's right or wrong with that?
Indeed. Can we move on to the Great Wall of China now? Stop any more publicity to Panos Zavos. Now, I don't know, Ian, why you're not as impressed as me at this story, that the Great Wall of China, one of the greatest achievements of human history, is 180 miles longer. It's like this is 180 miles that was just missing from one of the biggest constructions ever made. I mean, I know you can't see this from space, so I'm not going to say that. But still, this is incredible. This was found under various, old archaeological digs and things, and now nearly 4,000 miles long. And who knows if we'll find more sections of this wall?
Well, for me, my issue with this was it sounded like a classic, Onion headline along the lines of Area Man finds error on internet. I mean, the idea of the Great Wall of China being longer than previously thought is up there with all the climate change stories of things worse than previously previously thought. Everything's going to be worse. You know, always the error in calculation is always, you know, always going in one direction.
This is positive. It's not like someone was taking a sort of tape measure and then they measured it incorrectly. They literally found new bits of the wall.
But I went on the headline and I didn't. For me, it was like saying the M25 is longer than thought. I mean, here we have a fairly well-defined, you know, perimeter of something. And I thought with the Wall of China, we knew pretty much how long it was. But then you told me that the rest of it was subterranean. So I'll let you off.
It is subterranean. But also the sadder part of this, I suppose, is that it highlights the fact that lots of the wall is actually falling apart because different bits of the wall were obviously built from, you know, at different times in different dynasties. And some of them were built from bricks and have survived. And some of them were essentially mounds of earth that have been blown away because of the desertification of parts of northern China. So it's another climate change story, actually, that climate change, because of the farming practices in the 50s, meant that that these parts, they're not safe from winds anymore. There's lots more desert sand, etc. And, you know, unless you go and visit these 180 extra miles in, they could be gone by the time you're off this earth. You never know.
No, I think it's an extraordinary piece of investigative journalism, and I'd love to know what the Chinese government make of your finding.
Well, if you want to send me there, Chinese government, then please bring me. On to more serious things, obviously, galactic cores and what they taste of. I am not sure that you're a serious science journalist anymore, Ian. Despite what I said earlier, you had a story last week about chickens counting, clearly not true. And then now the Galactic Centre smells of raspberries. What made you write this Monty Python story?
A good question, but a absolute faith in the reliability of the sources and my own cleverness in finding out that when German scientists put out this press release and obviously mentioned nothing about raspberries, they did say that they had found the largest molecule ever to be found in interstellar space, and also that it was more interestingly, and seriously, it's the same size as the smallest amino acid, which is classically one of these things that scientists will call the building blocks of space. Now, obviously, I thought, well, I better find out what this large molecule they found is. It's called ethyl formate. And so you can imagine my joy when I found out that it was not only a molecule that is a bit like raspberry, it actually is the molecule in raspberries that makes raspberries taste of raspberries.
Did you go as far as Wikipedia to find that out?
Or? No, I went through some good, reliable chemistry department sources, and obviously then went back to the original researchers, and I said, you are aware that this molecule you found is the molecule responsible for the flavour of raspberries? And he said, yes, I did know that. And also, did you know it smells of rum? And I said, yes, I did know it smells of rum, but I thought it was better to say that this bit of cloud tastes vaguely of raspberries. I can only say vaguely because obviously there are a whole load of other molecules in there.
Arnaud Beloche, who's the astronomer at the Max Planck Institute, who I'm guessing you spoke to, there was that quote that I think you got from him. There are many other molecules that are needed to make space raspberries. And we're getting into slightly ridiculous things here now, but let's carry on. You're telling me the Great Wall of China story is a silly story.
No, I'm telling you that both headlines are silly.
Okay, well, it just reminds me of that phrase, that one line in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You know, John Cleese on top of the castle, the French knight. It's like, your mother, she smells of elderberries. Your galaxy, it smells of raspberries.
It's the ultimate galactic insult, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's terrible. One thing before we go, MI5 wants a science officer. Do you fancy the job?
Not remotely. I looked through the application procedure, and it's quite...
You did what?
I went through the application forms, and it's only a few days a week, which is good, and you'd be based in London. So, you know, 3 days a week, that's not bad. Probably reasonably good pay. You probably do need to be an FRS or, you know, Fellow of the Royal Society or Fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering. But they do let you off if you've got minor things on your criminal record, like speeding fines, or they'll probably let you off if you've smoked the odd joint at college.
Okay, David, do you as a neuroscientist have things you can give to the Secret Services?
Oh yeah, but I can't tell you about that.
All right, well, thanks everyone for all of that. You can find all those stories at guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment. Also, you can leave your thoughts on our blog, guardian.co.uk/science/blog.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Last week, environmentalists across the country waited with bated breath to find out if the government was going to put some of its money where its mouth is in terms of tackling climate change. Many saw the budget for 2009 as an opportunity to kickstart a Green New Deal for the UK, a way to put the country back on track to economic recovery and tackle climate change at the same time.
As well as saving energy, we need cleaner energy. But I'm aware that the credit squeeze is holding back major offshore wind projects. I want to lift the barriers through £525 million of new financial support over the next 2 years for offshore wind funded through the renewables obligation. The potential is enormous, and I'm confident this will lead to major projects getting the go-ahead quickly, providing enough electricity to meet the needs of up to 3 million households.
There was some good news for anyone with a concern about the future of the planet. Around £1.4 billion was earmarked for green measures. These included, as we heard, the more than £500 million to support new wind power projects, around £375 million to make our homes more energy efficient, and a commitment to build up to 4 carbon capture demonstration plants. But the budget wasn't as green-tinged as many had hoped. I spoke earlier to The Guardian's James Randerson and Damien Carrington about some of the nitty-gritty of the budget. I began by asking James to run through some of the less environmentally friendly parts of the government's proposals.
A scrappage scheme for cars, £300 million, to allow people to bring in their sort of 10-year-old models and trade them in for something better. Now, some people might try and portray that as an environmental measure because obviously modern cars are likely to be more fuel efficient, but in reality, it's just a way of supporting the car industry and the environment. You know, it will actually have environmental costs to it. We could talk a bit more about that if you wanted to. There's also more incentives to drill more oil in the North Sea, which obviously is not great for the environment.
Well, take us into that carbon budget thing for a second. That's a legally binding, not a target, but an actual budget. So it finds itself, it has to buy emissions credits from other places, essentially, if it goes
that's
over.
One of the interesting issues, if I can come in, Alok. The recommendation from the Climate Change Committee, which the government's accepted, is that there are 3 5-year budgets which lead to the 34% James talked about. And they say they will try and do it without buying any credits from abroad, which, of course, is a sort of get-out clause in a way. You know, if you sort of reduce emissions in a different country and just pay them to add them onto your total. If they don't meet these targets, they will fine themselves, it seems.
Well, let's look at some of the reaction then, Damien. What have the green groups been saying? I mean, for example, it surprises me that in the midst of all of the green package, we're going to be drilling for more oil as well. I mean, no one can be happy about that.
No, it's interesting. We're trying to do some sort of early numbers on it, and the 2 billion barrels of oil and gas, which they are giving tax incentives to get out of the North Sea, once they're used, will probably produce around 630 million tonnes of carbon, which, to put in context, is about the same as the UK emits as a whole every year. Now, as a comparison, one of the things that James hasn't mentioned that did get a fair amount of money was efficiency for buildings, which is a great way of saving carbon, but the 375 million which they're going to spend on that in the next 2 years will probably reduce emissions by only 380,000 tonnes. So that's 380,000 tonnes over 2 years, as opposed to 631 million from the oil. So, you know, if it works out that way, that's obviously not very balanced.
And actually, another thing we didn't mention was this on carbon capture and storage. The government sort of began to flesh out its commitment to that and said that they were going to extend the number of demonstration projects to 2 or maybe even 4.
So just going back a bit, the carbon capture and storage is the technology which hopefully will weed out the carbon dioxide from power stations and industrial sites and try and bury it underground. So far unproven, but the government so far has had one competition running, and this new announcement means that there's funding for what, 2 or more?
It's up to 4, I think. It's at least 2 and up to 4. I mean, the government are kind of hoping this is going to allow them to have their cake and eat it, because they're stuck between having to meet very strict emissions targets, which is very hard if you're burning coal, the dirtiest of all the fossil fuels. At the same time, they worry about energy security, both from existing plants which have to close down and also from the risk of relying on imported gas. So they hope that the carbon capture and storage is almost like a sticking plaster on a dirty plant. You can burn the coal, but because you're burying the CO2, but as you mentioned, Alok, it's not proven and it will be very expensive.
Well, some scientists argued actually you're going to burn that coal anyway, so you might as well just get it out the ground and then bury it back in again as carbon dioxide. Moving on to the reaction though, I mean, how does this compare to international attempts for Green New Deals that Obama's announced, for example, and others? Well, South Korea, for example.
Not well is the short answer.
Particularly not compared to South Korea.
No. I mean, South Korea have spent 80% of their fiscal stimulus, which is many, many billions. America, $150 billion. We're talking about $1.4 billion in the budget, not all of which is actual money. I mean, it's public and private money. The 525 for wind, for example, comes through a scheme which will ultimately end up on consumers' bills. So, you know, the... the reaction was kind of amazingly even across, you know, everyone agreed that whilst the Chancellor did not have a lot of money to spend and gave a reasonable amount of that to environmental measures, maybe around 10%, the problem is that with the targets that the country has set itself in the future, these enormous cuts, the amount of spending that's going in now is nowhere near enough to make those cuts. So that's the problem.
The wind energy people had something interesting to say as well, which was that they've got money for projects, which is great, but they still faced with a huge bill, so up to £15 billion, to actually connect that all of that stuff to the national grid. And this infrastructure problem is kind of still very much in the air.
In fact, on the same day, on Wednesday, there was a parliamentary select committee hearing where some of the big power companies were there saying how much it was going to cost to build some of the connections to take some of the renewable energy around the country, and basically saying the government's going to have to foot the bill.
The quick thing about cars, we talked last week about electric cars, £5,000 incentives to buy electric cars from 2011, mixed reactions to that. But this scrappage scheme, as you said, James, earlier, it's kind of environmental in one way, which is that if you've got a real old gas guzzler that's not very efficient, then jumping in and buying a much more efficient, smaller car is not a bad thing at all. But actually, the sums don't quite work like that, do they?
The real problem with the measure is that there are no strings attached. So you could, you know, trade in your sort of tiny little runaround that's 10 years old and go out and buy a Porsche Cayenne, you know. There's no need to buy a more efficient car. I mean, the other thing is about the embedded cost of the carbon included in making that vehicle. And actually, one analysis I've seen shows that, you know, it's not until a car becomes 18 years old that you're actually worth, you know, buying a new one. So I don't think there's any way at all that you can consider that a green measure.
One other thing to add to that, I suppose, is that it depends how many cars were going to be bought in the country anyway. If a million cars are already going to be bought and you incentivize people to buy more fuel efficient ones, and that's fine. If a million cars were possibly not going to be bought and you incentivize them to buy a million extra cars, that's never a good idea.
It doesn't even add up as a support for the car industry, because, you know, 80% of those cars are coming from abroad.
Okay, well, one other man who has been very vocal about the need for economic stimuluses to encourage investment in low carbon technologies and so on is Nicholas Stern. He was the man who reviewed the economics of climate change for Gordon Brown a few years ago, and he's just published a book. James, you went to see a lecture of his this week. What was he saying?
Yeah, he was speaking at the London School of Economics last week. He's, he gave his full title, Baron Stern of Brentford. He was chief economist of the World Bank and former head of the UK Government Economics Service, and obviously author of the famous Stern Review in 2006 that really kind of did the numbers on the economics of climate change, really. We're releasing this as a podcast extra as well, and I urge anyone who's at all interested to listen to it, because it's a fabulous, very clear exposition of the problem and his proposed solution. And obviously his proposed solution is all about using this huge wedge of money that governments around the world are putting in to deal with the financial crisis in the right way to bring in green measures. In the talk, there were things that he said before, like climate change is the biggest market failure the world has ever seen, and he was saying, you know, we can't have any new coal plants unless they've got CCS, and also that he underestimated the scale of the problem when he wrote the Stern Review. But for me, the most interesting bit was, it was quite a personal answer to a question towards the end, where a Guardian blogger, Ed Gillespie, asked him how he could be optimistic in the face of the problem, and this is his answer.
What's the alternative to optimism? Unless we act as if we can sort this out, you might as well just get a hat and some suntan lotion and write a letter of apology to your grandchildren. The only way we can think of going forward is to try to make the best of a bad starting point. So unless we set out cheerfully and collaboratively, we're going to fail. That doesn't mean being unrealistic or naive. It simply means trying to chart a course, understand the difficulties, talk them through, try practically to overcome them. I really don't see any other way. If we say, yeah, nothing's going to work, you know, the Russians will cheat, the Americans are not going to give up their SUVs, the Chinese don't care anyway, then the Brits are too lazy to do anything. The one way of guaranteeing to fail is to assume that we will. And we've got to be honest about the resources involved. So what we don't want is government that tries to say, well, this is going to be more expensive, and then opposition which jumps on it and says, you know, no way, we're not going to make people to pay more to go to Malaga or or the Seychelles or wherever they might go. We've got to face up to the two or three decades of quite serious costs that are involved. I think we've got the foundations. The challenge now is to translate that into serious action.
So that was Nick Stern. You can hear the full interview as a Science Extra. The links are on the blog. Damien, would Nick Stern be happy with the budgets announced last week?
No, I don't think he would. He's a very diplomatic fellow, but in the statement he made at the time, he basically said that it was a good start in the right direction, but nowhere near the scale of funding that was required. I mean, he said that 20% of the entire globe's fiscal stimulus, i.e. all this money that's been pumped in by governments to try and rescue the economy, should be spent on green measures, and we're simply coming up short.
Let me ask you both, just to wind up, if you were to give this budget a mark out of 10, James, for greenness?
For greenness, 4.
Damien?
I'd say 3. Yeah, right. The right idea, just not on the scale that's required.
Time now for some of your lovely listener feedback. Mindful M thought Norman Doidge's book was fascinating, saying, "I think he's doing society a great service by raising our awareness of the brain's ability to grow and change." Meanwhile, Son of a Baz again, we've heard from him before, or her, took us to task over our discussion about Baroness Greenfield's comments on gaming and social networking. "I thought the rallying against her was a bit lefty for my taste. Mary Whitehouse, although annoying, was largely right, wasn't she? As enlightened folk, don't we already know that when we are exposed to something, we absorb some of it? Social networking can take the place of real networking, and it leads to freaky people who don't know how to behave in polite society, which can lead to binge drinking and drug abuse to cope with feelings of awkwardness." I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. One thing before we wind up this section. In our programme on the 13th of April, Ian and I were explaining how a Higgs drive might work. Well, actually, Ian was, and I was disagreeing with him. An idea for an object that could make other objects massless, an anti-gravity machine, if you will. Ian pointed out the problems with the device, and then I said...
The question I have for you is, though, if something doesn't have mass, do the laws of physics work on it? Because there's nothing for gravity to grab onto, so actually it doesn't exist.
I don't even understand
that question. That's a philosophical question. Well, think about it. The second law...
Say it to me again,
Newton's second law of force equals mass times acceleration. If there's zero mass, there's no acceleration either, or force, for that matter. It wouldn't move.
But you're using, like, Newtonian physics on something which is to do with quantum theory.
Should work, though.
Well, there was something clearly wrong with that. On the line to put me right is Surrey University's Jim Al-Khalili. Jim, start the physics slapping. Welcome back, by the way.
Hello. Okay, well basically, the idea that if a particle doesn't have mass, then it's not affected by gravity. That I think, as Ian pointed out, that was a Newtonian view, which we now know is wrong, because our current theory of gravity is Einstein's general theory of relativity, which says that gravity isn't this magical sort of elastic band, this force that pulls all objects with mass together. It's what happens to space and time. So you get an object with mass and it curves space-time around it. Then anything traveling through that space and time will follow the curvature, even something without mass. And of course, the example that I immediately thought of was a particle of light, a photon. Now, photons don't have mass. More correctly, they don't have rest mass. And in fact, that's the reason why light can travel at the speed it does, which is the maximum speed in the universe. So a particle of light traveling in a gravitational field will follow a curved path, and it would appear as though it's being pulled by gravity, and that's what we see. So you don't need mass to have something moving and being affected by forces like gravity.
You see, it's all so clear to me now. And obviously, I know this. I'm not sure why.
I was just reminding you, I'm sure.
but can I ask you one other thing before we let you go? The reason that all came up was Ian had an idea for a thing called a Higgs drive, which it was a semantic creation for him. He doesn't know if it would work even. Ian, can you explain to Jim, who actually knows about this sort of stuff, what Higgs drive is? And then, Jim, can you tell him why it wouldn't work?
Jim, what I was saying, and just a bit of the background of this, there was... a guy at Oxford English Dictionary who had written a blog post about how a lot of terms in science had come about from science fiction.
I was listening to the podcast.
Right, yeah. Wonderful. And so I thought, well, I'll try and come up with a few sort of science fiction ideas of my own, and in the sort of, you know, crossing my fingers that they might crop up in future sci-fi novels. And one of the ideas was without very much thought, the idea of a Higgs drive, in which it's essentially, you know, the idea of an anti-gravity machine, where if you could find a way of cancelling out a Higgs field around something, then some people might think, okay, well, if you don't have a Higgs field, then the quarks and electrons in those, like, you know, the atoms, nuclei won't have any mass, therefore the whole thing might be massless, therefore you might be able to just give it a flick and you'll be, you know, you'll be to New York in no time at all. And then I pointed out that that's clearly not going to work because
atomic mass
comes not from the weight of the particles that make it up, but from, like, you know, the binding energies. But you tell me, would it work or not?
You're right that the Higgs field is what endows particles with mass. And so without a Higgs field, particles will be massless. What you also mentioned was that if you look at something like a proton, which we say is made up of three constituent quarks, if you add up just the masses of those quarks, that doesn't make up the mass of the proton, because there's energy inside it, what are called virtual particles, are constantly being created and sort of appearing and disappearing all the time. And at any given instance in time, there's a sea of these virtual particles. Now, whether having something that can switch off a Higgs field, bear in mind, we're not even sure that, you know, the Higgs mechanism is correct. You know, that's what the Large Hadron Colliders we're hoping is going to confirm or rule out. But assuming Higgs fields existed and we found a way of turning them off, whether that will then switch off, I think you're right. I don't think it would work, because it's not switching off energy. There will still be energy, and energy can always be changed into mass. This is Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared. So wherever you have energy, you can create particles just out of pure energy. They'll appear and disappear. So I wouldn't imagine a Higgs field would be able to cope with stopping that happening. So there will always be particles with mass appearing and disappearing. But look, I'm just rambling now.
I reckon you could get a degree in physics by listening to this podcast on a regular basis.
Absolutely. But not recommended.
Not the best way to do it, though. You're right. Jim, thank you so much. And thanks for being our physics check.
You're welcome.
Now, before we head off, we're going to quickly head back to David Eagleman, our neuroscientist. We were talking about raspberries before, and you mentioned that you've got a nice link between raspberries and what we want to ask you next about neuroscience.
Well, when you introduced the idea that the Milky Way tastes like raspberries, that immediately sounded to me like synesthesia. So synesthesia is a condition that I study in my laboratory, and it's where people have a mixture of the senses. So they might hear music and it causes them to physically see colors, or they might taste something and it makes them feel like they're touching something with their hands, or so on. And for many people, hearing a word puts a taste in their mouth. So when you said the Milky Way tastes like raspberries, I immediately thought that you were going to tell a story about synesthesia. In fact, I have a new book out on synesthesia called Wednesday is Indigo Blue, and it sounded something like your headline about the Milky Way tastes like raspberries, which will be my next book.
I tell you, the one thing, interesting thing about synesthesia that we've talked about this before on the podcast, is a fascinating thing. People sometimes don't realize they've had it until late into their lives. They've thought everyone surely can feel and taste colors. I mean, is that the experience you find in your lab?
Oh yeah, we accept the reality that's presented to us. So if you are colorblind, you wouldn't think that there is a different sort of world out there. And in fact, we now know that about 10% of women have a fourth type of color photoreceptor in their retinas, which means that they can see colors that we can't. That to us would look identical, to them they can distinguish them. So
what kind of colors?
I can't tell you. I mean, because it wouldn't make any sense to you.
So
if I presented two color placards to you right now, you would say those are exactly the same color. And for the women with this fourth type of photoreceptor, they would say, no, those are different. That you know, they can reliably discriminate those two colors.
And does it advantage them in any way, or could it have done historically?
Not necessarily. It's probably an accidental mutation, because it doesn't help them as interior designers if the rest of the population doesn't appreciate the subtle distinctions.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, well, on that very fascinating note, we'll have to wind up. David, thank you so much. Remember, David's book, Sum, 40 Tales from the Afterlives, is available at the Guardian Bookshop. That's guardianbookshop.co.uk. Thanks also to Ian Sample this week. You can find all the links, comments on the blog, and get Science Weekly updates on our website, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Also, check out the Twitter feeds, twitter.com/guardianscience and /scienceweekly. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. This programme was produced by Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.